We're talking about people who are starving to death right now, and you guys are fighting about, oh, this could take fewer milliseconds. Hello and welcome to Terrifying Robot Dog. I'm Jonathan Stark.
I'm Kelly Shaver.
And we're here to talk about how technology is changing the way we interact with the world. This week, we talk about blockchain. Please stay tuned. Terrifying Robot Dog is next.
I promise that's more exciting than it sounds.
I was trying to come up with something clever, but it just didn't come to me. I haven't been sufficiently caffeinated. It also occurs to me that that by the end of this, we'll realize that we were talking about something much more specific than blockchain in general, but I don't know what it is yet because it's still kind of hazy.
Right. I just know that it's not Bitcoin.
It's not. Right. It's not. It's like, you know, it's like blockchain's kind of like TCP/IP and Bitcoin's kind of like email. Probably not a great analogy, but they're close.
I get it. But
yeah, closely related, but not the same thing.
Mm-hmm. But first.
Let's talk about 3D printing, the soothing sounds.
My 3D printer arrived yesterday, which is about a month earlier than I expected it to, so that was nice.
Wow, that's a significant upgrade.
Yeah, it was backordered for quite some time, and I think a lot of places are still listing it as out of stock, but somehow Amazon managed to get me one and ship it my way.
Perhaps they deployed some 3D printers to print out some more 3D printers.
They could have. Yeah, so I picked up the Monoprice Select Mini 3D printer, which is the $199 fully assembled, not a kit, out of the box, ready to go, small 3D printer.
Wow.
It's about a 4.75 cubic area, print area. So, You know, not tiny, but smaller than something expensive, certainly, but not unusably small.
How, like, what would you compare it size-wise to? Like, bigger than a bread box?
The printer itself is, it's maybe 16 inches high, and it's actually got a smaller footprint on the desk than my inkjet printer does.
Mm. So kind of like a medium-sized desk plant. Printing plant. Years ago, talked about 3D printing. It probably wasn't that long, but there are lots of different kinds. Is this one like a filament feed, or is it, like, how does it? Okay.
Yeah, this is a filament. It extrudes the filament onto the bed. And
And so I know you've been using it feverishly since its arrival.
Yeah, I think it's had about a 4-hour break between the hours of 6:30 and 10:30. Because we have to sleep at some point. But yes, we've been printing several things. Mostly Dungeons and Dragons terrain tiles. So, I mean, you know, we have our priorities straight.
Exactly. So. Right. Not to feed into the stereotype, ladies and gentlemen, but
yeah, not at all. But after I get done printing a few, Richard has told me he's going to spend the day printing some D&D terrain, and then tonight, overnight, I think I'm going to try for a couple of sci-fi prop replicas.
Nice.
So, you know, not to feed into the stereotype at all.
Right. I have a friend who has a 3D printer and uses it exclusively for printing out Star Wars ships for some game that he plays. It's a tabletop game.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I never thought of making my own ships for that.
Yeah. I can't remember the name of the game, but it's like a strategic.
Cheaper, sounds like.
Yeah. It's kind of like, you probably know it. It's some sort of, I don't know, like Risk strategy game with.
Isn't it the one? It's not what Cooper was unboxing a while back, was it?
I think it was. I think we bought like a starter kit for it, but he just does not click with board games. Mm. He just wants to play with the pieces, and then like 5 minutes later, he doesn't care about it.
Right. Well, he's still a little young for it, so.
Yeah, I suppose.
But yeah, first impressions are good. We ran into. Actually, setup was very easy. It was, mostly plug and play. I mean, there was a little bit of work to do, but it wasn't nearly as fiddly as I expected it to be, or I think as fiddly as 3D printing used to be, or maybe can be for the most part. The bed was level. Everything worked right off the bat, and you just plug in your SD card with your model on it and hit print, and that's that. You just, go, take a nap.
So you didn't make the models. Would you download them from somewhere?
Yeah, we've been getting them from Thingiverse.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you certainly can make your own models, and I'm probably going to give that a try at some point just because it seems fun to model something and then print it out. But we haven't gotten that far into it yet. We've just been downloading models that other people have put up on Thingiverse.
Mm, cool. God, that's cool.
Yeah, it's so neat to watch it. It's it's a slow process, of course. It comes with a demo of a little object of like a little lucky cat figurine that's maybe 2.5-3 inches tall. Mm-hmm. And I think that took, I think it said 2 hours and 55 minutes to print. So, you know, you can't be in any hurry.
Right. I mean, imagine, just imagine, this is probably, you know, there's probably a physics problem here, but imagine if it took 30 seconds, like what a difference that would be. You know, yeah. If you were like, if it took 30 seconds, because then you, all of a sudden you have this experimentation concept where you can experiment with stuff, and it's kind of, it kind of reminds me of dial up, like old, what was it? 26 baud dial up modems.
2600 baud modems. Yeah.
Yeah. You thought twice before clicking on a link. You'd be like, oh, I don't know. Is this worth it?
Right. Like, how bad do I want to see that image?
Yeah. And you click and wait. So now it's like, with it so much faster, you experiment more. You like blink around, like, ah, just back, forward, back. Doesn't matter. You don't, you don't think about anything. You can get it more into that surfing mentality. And I imagine with, if printing was so much faster, not even better quality, but just faster, how that would affect things. It would, I'm sure it would have a gigantic effect.
Yeah, I'm sure it would. I mean, I could speed up the print time on this. You could print with less fill density and a faster rate, and you would lose quality. But if you just wanted to prototype something to like make sure it was the right, you know, maybe if you're making a part for something, you want to print something to make sure it's the right size before you... Or that sort of thing. But still, it's going to take, you know, it's going to take longer than 30 seconds. It's going to take, you know, you might cut a 3-hour print down to 1.5 hours.
Mm. Yeah, like if you could print a coffee cup faster than you can make a cup of coffee, that would be...
Right.
Print the whole thing. Print me a coffee cup full of coffee.
A coffee cup full of coffee, yeah. you want a replicator off of Star Trek, don't you?
Yeah, I've been saying that for years. It's like, we aren't done until I can print a coffee, which Keurig is getting remarkably close to.
They are.
So, but anyway, that's very cool. Thanks for the update there.
It's a lot of fun. I'll send you some links to photos.
Yes, perhaps we could get ongoing updates. Yeah, photos would be cool. We can send the photos out to our growing mailing list.
Our ever-growing mailing
ever-growing
list,
yes. Almost up to the 20s.
So, oh, wow.
Ladies and gentlemen, you can join our mailing list. We'll talk about that more later.
Yeah, our mailing list can almost legally buy a drink.
Not quite. The grubs are darn fast.
Yep.
But ladies and gentlemen, yes, today we're going to talk about blockchain, which I do not believe we have discussed at all ever.
We may have mentioned it briefly as in, oh, blockchain would be good for this, but I don't think we've ever gone into detail on what it is and how it works and why it's good.
Yeah, there might have been a Bitcoin conversation way back. So the concept here is to start to dig into what I think will be a little bit of an ongoing topic on the show, because I was super interested in Bitcoin early on because of the idealistic notion of it. It was like the internet version of money. Mm-hmm. Not just money for the internet, but it was when I was younger and first started to understand the internet, the thing that I could not get my head around was no one owns it. I could not conceive of that. Like, I can't even express to you how weird it was to me that a company didn't own it. Like, I was like, how could it work?
Yeah, you know? I was like, what got me was not only did no one own it, but it's not just like, it's not one thing sitting somewhere.
Yeah, there's no off switch. There's no centralized control.
Yeah, there's a great video we'll have to link to.
Okay. So, and of course, that is kind of like a key feature of the internet is that no one's really in charge of it. Mm-hmm. So... it's just, you know what it, I suppose everybody knows what it is now. It's a series of tubes. So,
right.
But it's like, how did all this infrastructure get there? And like, how did, but it really was on top of other infrastructure. It was just the whole story. So over time that gave us all sorts of interesting things. Of course, you know, like I suppose bulletin boards were maybe first, and then email was the next mm-hmm. one that came up that was really huge and still is, of course. Mm-hmm. And then the web naturally. And you know, and if you want to, I almost want to call videos something YouTube type stuff. It's almost not the web. But anyway, so all of these applications are built on top of the internet, but it's not just the wires and the radio signals that make this, the physical infrastructure of the internet that makes it work. It's also the concept of things like TCP/IP and all
those protocols. And
yeah, the protocols, thank you, that came up with an approach for moving bits from here to there in a way that was going to be reasonable. And one of the big, I guess, revolutionary ideas back then was that it was going to be best effort, right? Like TCP/IP's best effort. It's like if something, we just trust that everything's going to make it to the other end and get reassembled. And there's no validation of that.
And sometimes there's packet loss and sometimes there's not. And if there is, then, you know, oh, well, there's a bit of data that you might have missed, but we're going to carry on.
Right. But that idea was so, it was almost as, you know, I wasn't old enough to be part of the discussion, you know, like there wouldn't have even been a discussion the way there is now. Like if there was a Twitter back then, I was too young to have been, you know, yelling back and forth about that being a good or bad idea. But a lot of people thought that was a horrible idea. Mm-hmm. They were like, how are you kidding me? Like not validating that the letter ended up at the other end of the, you know, in the right mailbox.
This idea that, oh, computers can't be best effort. It's either a yes or no.
Right.
It's either it's there or it's correct or it's not.
Right. So there's this sort of perfect or nothing crowd, which was the majority, if I'm remembering my internet history properly. And then there was sort of the Vint Cerf people that were like, nah, it'll be fine. Don't worry about it. You know, it'll be good enough. And they were right. Sure enough, it is good enough. Is it perfect? Of course not. But is it incredibly useful? And perhaps the crowning achievement of, you know, the web is perhaps the crowning achievement of like the human race so
far. Human race, yeah.
So, okay. So the reason I sort of went into all that is because blockchain feels like that to me in different ways. But blockchain and, of course, Bitcoin being the first killer app of blockchain is super interesting in the exact same kind of way.
Yeah, it really is. And mm-hmm. it's a really interesting thing to base a currency off of.
Right. So it's kind of like, man, this is like, it's hard to know where to start with this, but I guess it's fair to say I'm like, I can feel myself going down the rabbit hole on this. Like I'm so much more interested in this like I can't stop. Like I've been not doing other things that I'm supposed to be doing because I want to keep on reading about this. I can feel it sucking me in. And so I'm sure that we're going to talk about this more, and I promise you that it will be interesting because a lot of this stuff, it's really hard to find any kind of sensible explanation of any of this.
Yeah, blockchain is a confusing, well, I want to say it's a confusing concept or a confusing, complicated thing. I guess the basic concepts aren't that bad, but it's, I don't know, it feels like one of those things like trying to explain regular expressions.
Yeah. Yes. And it's hard to explain something that doesn't have a common application on top mm-hmm. of it. It's pretty hard to explain the internet because you don't even know where to start talking about it. There's like the physical infrastructure, then there's the transport layer and all that stuff. There's like so much stuff going on, but it's hard to explain. But you can explain email to somebody pretty easily. You know, it's like mm-hmm. it's like you type into this, you type here, press send, you know, put my email address in here, press send, and it shows up on my computer. Like, oh, that's pretty useful. You know, a lot of the technology we talk about, self-driving cars and VR and AR and chatbots and AI and all that stuff. To me, this is the one that is the most, oh my God, like, oh, no way, you know? So, but it's hard to describe because there's a giant lack of examples.
There's a lack of examples. Right now, the only example we have really is Bitcoin. And then people get all hung up in the whole currency aspect of that. I guess just it's money. It's a sensitive subject. People have weird feelings mixed up and around it and things.
Yep.
And that's really the only good example we have of it right now. But it's one of those things where as security and privacy and verification of identity and all of that becomes more important over time, then I think we're going to start to see blockchain playing more, a bigger role in that.
I would be willing to go far enough to say, am I 100% positive blockchain is going to be a big deal? Because in my research, the banks are already like getting in on the game.
Mm-hmm.
Which is smart because it's a threat. You know, I don't think it'll be an actual threat to the world banking for a long, long time, but it does disintermediate governments and banks and like credit card companies from certain things that they currently make a lot of money off of. So, okay. And also maybe we'll get into this or maybe not, but I can also see a part of the reason why it's hard to get any information about it that's understandable is because all of the descriptions seem to be either absurdly childish, mm-hmm. like literally using the words magic in places, or it's like you have to read a
white paper,
a CS white paper, right? So then everything that's kind of in the middle is a flame war of people who are kind of, it seems to me that there are two camps of people involved in especially Bitcoin, because it seems to be the most well-known. But there's kind of two camps of people going on. One are the total cypherpunk idealists who I've you know, been watching videos of, literally screaming and crying about, I mean, like emotional, literally crying about, you know, like financial terrorism and the Central Bank of Japan is a terrorist, Madeleine Albright is a terrorist, and, you know, they're killing babies by sanctioning countries. And like people get, I mean, these people are 100% genuine. They may be a little wing nutty, but I can see it. I can see why somebody would be like, you know, just giant state actors holding money over people's heads and deaths ensue.
Yeah, and especially when you think about this, we have some questionable goings on ourselves right now, but a lot of people in a lot of countries are in governments that are a lot more maybe oppressive and tightly control those things than ours. They have a lot Absolutely. Less personal freedom to begin with, so.
Right. And so let's call that the kind of idealist camp, and they're almost the political camp.
Mm-hmm.
And then it seems to me that there's another camp that are the geeks, like all of these guys are geeks and gals, but there's the kind of the we're going to save the world people. And then there's the people that are like, we're going to optimize this. Like this is, they're like, blockchain's inefficient. It's like, yeah, that's why it works.
Yeah.
And they're like, no, but it's too slow. And then the political people are like, you don't understand. This is a question. It's not on or off. You know what I mean? It's
yeah.
like you, there's like the group that wants to, almost at all costs, they see a way to take control away from central authority over money. And that's all they care about. And if it's a little bit slow, so what? Or if it hasn't been properly abstracted to apply to things other than money, like contracts and identity, so what?
So what?
We're talking about people who are starving to death right now. And you guys are fighting about, oh, this could be like, this could take a few, you know, fewer milliseconds. And
yeah.
you can see why there's a huge, because, you know, there's a lot of fighting going, tons of flame wars going on in like the communities around cryptocurrency. It's fascinating. I love it. So cool.
Yeah. I feel like though we haven't really explained what blockchain is or the basics of how it works. Should we maybe discuss that for a few minutes before we continue on?
Yeah, we should. I'm trying to lay some groundwork here because there's some stuff. Well, yeah, let's stop throat clearing. do you want to take a swing at it, or should I take a whack?
I can attempt to take a swing at it.
Cool.
Okay, there, I failed.
I'll do my best.
I have an understanding of it, but it's hard. Like you said, it's hard to formulate in a way to explain it.
Yeah, like what level do you come at it?
So yeah, exactly.
So there's a couple of I'm going to try from a couple different angles, because there's an analogy that I found the most eye opening, which is, if you imagine you're just sitting on a park bench next to your friend, and you know, so you and me are sitting on a park bench.
Okay.
I have an apple. I give it to you. Now you have the apple.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question about that, right? It doesn't even make sense for me to say that. Like, yeah, obviously. It's like, yeah, now
right. yeah.
I don't also still have the apple.
Right.
You know, there's no, it's like this physical world thing. So when you move into the digital realm, I can just, you know, and we have a picture of an apple. I can just make a million copies of the apple and keep on giving it to you, or I could give it to you and I could give it to Erica. It mm-hmm. like, I, you know, indistinguishable copies. I could keep giving away, keep giving away, keep giving away. So the problem, I think the big problem that really blockchain solves is that you can't keep giving away the same digital apple. You've got one, you have ownership over one
digital apple.
Digital picture. Let's not even say apple. Like, you've got a picture of an apple because everybody's familiar with photos, and that you can copy them very easily for free, essentially,
mm-hmm.
infinitely, essentially. So how do you ensure that what is also just a digital file, which is your bank account, you don't just start duplicating it
and giving out copies of your money?
All right. Why don't I just make copies of this $10 bill, this picture of this $10 bill that I can pay with, and distribute that to whoever I want? So, you know, I've got my own little counterfeiting business on my computer where I just duplicate pictures of $10 bills that I can then, you know,
send. Yeah.
Right. Like, imagine if I could pay my brother by taking a picture of a $10 bill and sending it to him. And then I'm like, oh, I've still got this picture. I'm just going to keep duplicating it and send it to somebody else I owe 10 bucks to. And then I'm going to make 100 copies of it and send it to somebody I owe 100 bucks to. So they're getting these emails with attachments of this single source $10 bill. Blockchain prevents that.
Yeah, what you need is a bunch of people to say, oh, hey, you've already sent that $10 bill picture. You don't have it anymore. You can't do that again.
Right. And so now the other thing that's the other thing that this is not the other thing. It's another way to talk about it is that in the Apple scenario, the physical Apple scenario, there's no credits, debits. There's no you owe me. There's nothing of that. Like I have the Apple. Now you have the Apple. It's always ownership. It's never there's no owing. You never owe anyone anything. So, which I find a fascinating distinction, and in fact, is the thing that should scare banks and everybody else in the middle, because a lot of, I mean, that I almost said entire, but big chunks of the financial industry are in charge of me keeping track of how much money I have, so I can't duplicate my $10 bills because they're not in my database. They're in Bank of America's database, and if I want to pay somebody, there's like 100 ways I could do it. I could use a debit card. I could use a credit card. I could use a check. I could use cash. I could go take cash out of an ATM. And their job is to kind of reconcile all of those things and kind of sync them up on the other end. And, you know, I work with credit unions, and it's if you go into a typical banking app and you want to pay somebody, you in a lot of these applications, you'll be faced with a lot of more options than you think. Than you expect. So like you go in and it's like, first it's like, do you want to pay a person or a company? It's like, who cares?
Yeah.
And then you're like, okay, is this a transfer between your accounts at this bank, or is this a transfer between your account at this bank and an account at another bank that's yours? Or is this a transfer between you and somebody else's account at another bank? Is this a transfer between you and someone else who has an account with us? It's like, who cares?
Do you want to give a routing number or a debit card number or
Right. And so now the reason that that's there is because that's the reality behind the scenes, and they haven't done, in my opinion, the best job possible hiding all of that junk. In other words, they're kind of exposing their innards to someone who's not even, in some cases, capable of answering the question that's being asked. It's like, I don't know if, you know, let's say I want to pay you. I don't know if you have a Bank of America account or not. Like, how would I even know that?
Right. You
know?
You'd have to ask me.
Right. And it's like, so there's just tons of friction in the process. But the point of bringing it up is that behind the scenes of even I mean, mobile banking is pretty great compared to what it was 10 years ago even. So I'm not necessarily complaining, but I'm just using it as an example to kind of illustrate that there's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes that is really, really complicated and extremely expensive. We're talking about planes flying from city to city with giant boxes of checks inside them. So like physically sending them in the air to another place. So it's like, it's funny because on the one hand, it's still not seamless and there's a ton of stuff going on back there. Anyway, it's like crazy complicated behind the scenes. And this, and to get back to the Apple thing, there's a lot of lag time between when I say, yes, I want to pay Kelly $10, and when you actually have the $10.
Well, I mean, you know, we did this just a while ago, and it took, what, 3 business days?
Yeah, and that was, I think, I could have paid more for it to be faster, interestingly. But there's a slower way and a faster way for me to digitally send the money to you, which it's like so crazy. But the problem with that lag time is, here, getting back around to the blockchain, the problem with the lag time is that you can kite checks, or you can write bad checks. I could write 10 bad checks and get away with it. You know?
Yeah. You can get away with it with writing checks, and because nobody's going to know until they try to deposit those checks, and then those deposits don't clear. And then,
And another thing that you can do, which is a lot less of a big deal, but you can also redeem coupons repeatedly. So if you go to if you get a digital coupon on your phone, it's almost certain that any retailer out there right now, I don't think maybe Target has gotten hip to this, but I don't think so. You can go in and you're essentially just showing a barcode on your phone, and you can redeem a coupon that's a single use coupon. You can go, if you want to drive to like 5 Targets or 5 Joann's in a row, you can keep on using that same coupon.
Well, we'll say Starbucks, because there's one of those on every corner.
Yeah. Starbucks might be hip to it, actually.
Yeah, Starbucks might be. I wouldn't surprise me if they are.
Yep. Okay. So that's kind of, it's a little bit hard to talk about blockchain without kind of having to go through all that junk. There's a huge period of time when stuff's out of everybody's, out of the people, the two parties of the transaction, you and me. There's a surprisingly long amount of time and friction and cost that's going on behind the scenes to get that from media.
Yeah. And the money during that time period, oftentimes is just kind of off in the ether somewhere. It's removed from your account. It's not yet in mine. Mm.
Yeah. Funny you should say ether.
We're hoping it shows up.
Yes.
Yes.
So the way that, let's talk about, there's different blockchains. There's different ways to use it, but it kind of solves that problem. Mm-hmm. And it creates a way for me to send you $10 and it not have to go through any central or trusted authority, which sounds crazy, but you could kind of say, it's like the whole world almost is watching me give you the $10. And even though I sent you a picture of my $10 bill, they're all looking at me like, okay, and you have to rip up the one in your pocket, you know?
Yeah. It's like having a public ledger.
It's exactly like that.
Yeah. And I mean, they it's exactly like that. Yeah. They can't see the, oh, you spent $10 on such and such hamburger, but they're seeing a series of encrypted hashes that represent your money.
Yep. So let me try and talk about that. So imagine in any transaction that it's logged in a public database. So it's kind of like saying, it's not exactly like saying everyone can see your account balance, but I'll talk about that more in a second. This is fascinating too, but it's like the whole world can look and see that I already gave somebody the $10, so I can't do it mm-hmm. again. And once it's done, you can't rewrite history. Without getting into the technical aspect of it at all, imagine that there's only one of these, and from the time you were born, this is how it worked. You're born, and your parents give you an allowance, let's say, after a few years. They do that by taking some kind of currency, let's just say Bitcoin to keep it simple.
Okay.
They take some Bitcoin, they give it to you because you fed the dogs every day for a week. Okay, great. Now you've got Bitcoin. So you are now my kid. Let's use examples. Cooper, I give him Bitcoin for feeding the dogs. So now all of a sudden Cooper's on the network. He's got a user account in, mm-hmm. he's got an entry in this giant public database that no one is in charge of, just like the internet.
And it's not kept in one place either.
No.
We'll get into that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. So now it's in the database. And now Cooper's got, let's say, one Bitcoin, because I'm really generous about my dog feeding duties. I give him one Bitcoin for feeding the dogs. Okay, great. Now he's got that. It's digital. It's a digital file, just like a, you know, stock or my balance at Bank of America. It's just a digital balance that's there. So now if he goes and gives that to someone else later, gives it to Maggie because he doesn't want to feed the dogs that day. So he gives her half a Bitcoin. Now Maggie shows up in the ledger and it says that Cooper, I gave Cooper his first Bitcoin, so he's got one, and now he gives it to Maggie, now a half of it, so now they both have half. He could duplicate a local, if he had some local copy of that file, of the Bitcoin I gave him, I'm air quoting like crazy, because that's not even a concept. But let's just say you think about it like physical money, like I gave him $10. If he had that on some hard drive, or if he could even get into the public database and duplicate his records, or edit it even, mm-hmm. everybody else would be like, would call foul. They'd be like, no, you right. can't do that. Like,
no, you can't.
Right. So it's kind of like, you just put it another way. Right now, somebody at Bank of America could mess with my account or their own account. Let's say somebody at Bank of America banks at Bank of America. Mm-hmm. I promise you there's a database administrator in there who would certainly get fired and go to jail and all those other things, but is capable of going in and giving himself money. Promise you. There's absolutely no doubt in my mind.
Oh, yeah.
So, and if not Bank of America, then somebody else. Sorry, Bank of America.
Yeah, not to pick on you. I think any bank can do this.
Yeah, I'm sure that there's some database, some person with access to a database who has a lot to lose by doing this, more than it's worth to do it, but could certainly do it. So now, a way to possibly hedge against that would be to give access to the entire world to that database and have incentives in place that would prevent tampering, or it's certain immediately, instantly reveal tampering. So it's just that didn't come out as strong as I thought. I thought it was going to be a stronger analogy. I was like, imagine if everybody banked with Bank of America, and then Bank of America just made their database public. Then it would be like, oh, okay, well, anybody could just audit this.
Right. And they didn't just make it public. They said, here, you have a copy and you have a copy and you have a copy.
Yeah. So let's get into that, because how is it, Kelly, that just because this database is public, how is it that there still isn't some guy or gal that could go in there and mess with their own record and give themselves more money?
Well, it's because this database is also distributed. I guess think of it similar to maybe BitTorrent, where there are multiple, or version control like Git, where there are multiple copies of this database out there. And so if you change one, it's not going to have a big effect other than to raise alarm bells that says, hey, this has been tampered with. It's no longer valid.
Exactly. So part of the protocol is that the database is replicated completely across, I checked last night, there are right now almost 7,000 nodes that are checking.
I'm surprised there's not more.
Yeah, I was too, actually. It might, it's possible that the number I was looking at was not representative of the thing I thought. I expected it to be more.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think each of those nodes represents a computer. I think it represents, because there are three huge groups that mine as a collective. I have a feeling they count as one each.
Okay. Yeah, and it's the mining that is that verification process.
Yeah, and so now this gets into one of the things I find annoying when I was trying to find information, is that mining is a terrible analogy for what they're doing. It's an analogy, but it's not a terrible analogy, but very few people go past that.
Yeah, it's like the term was created for the sake of sounding cute with the whole coins.
Exactly. We're mining gold.
Yeah.
And okay, but explain what you're doing, you know? And it's like, oh, well, we're solving puzzles. It's like, come on, tell me what you're doing. You know, it's like, well, solving these puzzles. So I'm gonna try and describe my understanding of what's going on. Basically, like you just said, mining is the process of validating the transactions. But here's the thing that I didn't. So then I was like, well, how do they validate the transactions? Like, how is that valid? So check this out. This might be obvious to you, but it was like a major light bulb moment for me. The notion of Bitcoin mining or validating the transactions goes kind of like this. So if I want to send you $10, I basically put that transaction, I put that desire into the ether, as they always refer to it. So it's kind of like I've just sort of posted to the Bitcoin network.
Hey, I want to do this thing.
Yeah. And it goes into a queue. So everybody that's all the Bitcoin desired Bitcoin transactions are just going up into the queue, and miners, or you could also call them validators, go around and grab a chunk of stuff off the queue, and they need everybody says they need to solve this puzzle, and it's a really hard puzzle to solve, so it takes their computer a while to do it. So it's kind of like a race. But there are a couple of things there's a ton of things that aren't 100% clear, but I think the way it works is people who grab a chunk of stuff off the queue aren't grabbing the same chunk and racing to solve the same chunk necessarily. In fact, it doesn't really matter.
Mm-hmm.
Please correct me if I'm wrong, dear listener, if you know more about this.
I think they could be, but it doesn't really matter.
They can be, but it doesn't matter, right? And so what's going on is at all times, somebody, one of these miners, is trying to validate a chunk of transactions, which is called a block. And if they successfully do that, then it kind of gets passed around to the other miners or nodes to validate, to check their work, basically.
Yeah.
And once it passes that test, that block gets attached to all the other blocks that came before it in a big chain, hence blockchain. And I don't want to get into the hashing part yet, but the way that they validate it isn't that they check some account balance that I have. So I want to give you $10, let's say 10 Bitcoins. They find me. And they go back through every single transaction that I've ever done, and they do the math.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, does he have the 10 Bitcoin? He does. All right. So now it's like not instantly, but, you know, because of the process of validating the transactions, it's not instant, but it's pretty quick. It becomes yours now. So now that there's an entry in your ledger, blockchain, right, that is public to everyone. And later, if you ever go to spend one, let's say you go to spend 1,000 Bitcoin you're going to send to Richard. Then some miner grabs that transaction out of the ether, you know, out of the queue.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things they do is go back through the entire chain, the entire hash, to the very beginning of your history, at some point when you receive some Bitcoin, and goes all the way back up and is like, does she have enough Bitcoin to send, you know, whatever I said, 100 to Richard?
Yeah. And it's doing the math every time. So if you can't hack it somewhere in the past without breaking your blockchain.
Right. And And if you did that, then your database would be out of sync with the vast majority of other databases out there.
Yeah. So when the other miners went to check your work, it would be like, oh, nope, this is not.
Right. The blockchain's invalid. It's almost like the, you know, for geeks, it's like the H.264 hash is wrong. Mm-hmm. So it's throw it away. So the bigger the network gets, the more difficult it would be to hack the system. Because you could hack the system by like taking over 51% of the mining nodes, mm-hmm. and just completely saying like, yeah, that's a valid transaction, even though we all know it's not. We are in cahoots, but already the network is so big that would be pretty difficult to do. So if it got bigger, it would be even less likely that there would be any way to reasonably doubt the truth that's recorded in the public ledger. This is super fascinating. Did that make any sense?
Yeah.
I hope so.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
All right. So now here's the leap that a lot of people make, and it's like the end of every article about this is like, and that's going to change everything. And it's not, I've been thinking about it a lot, and I can think of some things that are sort of interesting, but it's not obvious at all how that's going to change everything.
Outside of currency, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's the sort of, you know, when I was younger, I'm not going to brand all young developers as immature, but when I was younger and a much more immature developer, the first thing I wanted to do with everything was abstract every problem into something up a level. So it's kind of like,
you're that guy that made his own framework, aren't you?
Sort of, yeah. But it was more like, because I started programming from the database side of things.
Okay.
So, and you know how I'm like obsessive over naming things?
Tribes.
Yeah. I would always try to, like, I always wanted to abstract something. So if a customer said to me, we have vendors and we have customers, I'd be like, oh, that should just be one table. It's like just a parties table or a tribes table or like it's going to have practically the same fields. So we're just going to abstract it, like, and left my own devices, I ended up with a table, like a file with like one table in it or like three that really should have 50 because I would over abstract things like crazy.
Yeah.
So I'm like, oh, but you know, if we put these in vendor and customer tables, if a customer ever becomes a vendor, then we'll have to have them in two places. And you know, and like I could support my old argument still. But in reality, it's dumb because it's just not pragmatic because I'm programming an entire system for the edge case. But so here's the thing, I think a lot of the flame war thing is people are like, but this could be useful for so much beyond just Bitcoin if it just didn't have these fundamental flaws that would allow it to be abstracted to any part of life, like smart contracts and real estate forms and identity and all these other things. And it's almost like the Bitcoin people are like, no, the thing, like, it's for what it's for, you know?
Right.
And it's optimized heavily for what it's for. And the thing that I'm seeing as I go through this research is that there are people who, and they're usually banks, it seems, who want private blockchains.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's a weird concept.
Yeah, it's like an internet. Like, okay, we want the benefits of like networked computers, but we don't want everybody on the network.
Yeah, it's like, oh, we want the benefits of the verification and the validation and all that, but only within this group that we say.
Yeah, and now all this, and the other thing is the it becomes centralized. Immediately it becomes centralized because they have to have validators because there's no... You can't just have immediately becomes centralized because you can't have anonymous people on the network validating it.
Right. The banks want to be the ones that are validating everything.
Yeah. Right. And in their defense, they are subject to regulations that probably would make it impossible for them to, you know, conform to an audit if they were using the public blockchain.
Right.
Well, who validated these numbers? The network did. Okay.
Like, well.
Yeah. You know, 100,000 people on the network validated it. Well, who are they? Where's the list of names? We don't have a list of names. What are you even talking about? So the private blockchain thing and startups that are doing private blockchains, not that there couldn't be more than one blockchain, but I think they need to be public for it to really make sense or to be truly useful. to the average person who's trying to give $10 to somebody else. But you can sort of see why a banking institution would be like, okay, there's some definite benefits here. I like the idea, but for at least three good reasons, we can't do it, but we want to take advantage of some of it. So hence you end up with the concept of like a, you know, if we're using the internet analogy, then it's kind of like an intranet or something like that.
Yeah. Your blockchain on your own VPN or that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I can understand why they want that and why in some cases it might even be necessary or useful. But on the whole, it sort of feels like it, I don't want to say defeats the purpose, but it kind of feels like it goes against the spirit of it a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, the spirit of it is to destroy banks. So the fact that they're...
Bitcoin specifically, yeah.
Yeah. So okay. There's so much going on with this. It's super interesting. I don't know. There are a couple of interesting sort of scenarios that can present themselves that might be overly geeky, like if the blockchain forks and how that gets resolved. And I don't know. I just, in general, the concept though is that it's a digital construct that prevents meddling with history. Mm-hmm. That is it. So it's like, it's an audit trail that you can't mess with. It's a server log that cannot be changed without collusion between hundreds of thousands of people and spending probably more money than it's worth to try to hack it. It just becomes, compared to hacking, like, I don't know, bank database, it'd be way easier to just hack a bank database.
Yeah.
Just get someone on the inside and do it.
Yeah. It's security through like sheer volume and the amount of time it would take.
Mm.
It just makes it really not practical and not worthwhile. And by the time you manage to hack it, you'd never catch up because it's going to take so long to hack it that things are going to be continually added to it while you're trying to brute force your way in or whatever.
Yeah. And honestly, that's kind of one of the, I don't know, I can't decide how big it, I think the new me, the more mature me is like, it's good enough because you could imagine like, well, what if there's a quantum leap in computing power? Or what if like some AI can just figure this out and just mess with it? But it doesn't matter because that would be, if those things happened, it would still be easier to hack Bank of America's database or some central bank's database. It's just easier.
Yeah, we're still, regardless of what kind of clever algorithms we come up, we're still limited by the hardware.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. So it reminds me of the bear joke, you know, two guys are walking in the woods and a bear jumps out and one of the guys stops to put sneakers on. And the other guy goes, what are you doing? You can't outrun a bear. And he goes, I don't have to outrun the bear. I just have to outrun you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like messing with the blockchain seems like it would be, it's the guy with the sneakers on. Like there's just, it's the hardest thing to do. So it seems like even if you had the financial incentive, which theoretically you could imagine, it'd just be too hard. It's like everybody on the planet is standing there being like, no. No, that didn't just happen. Sorry, that's not real. You already gave that picture of the $10 to someone. So you cannot, I don't care if you have,
stop it. You know.
I don't care if you have 10 million pictures of that $10 bill. We know you gave it away once and that's the only thing that matters. That's why it's so interesting that to me, it's a big mental shift between owing and ownership. That is a fascinating difference. There's never with the possible exception of the validation period. No, it's not because it's still yours. Like
it's still yours until it's validated.
Until it's validated, and then it's instantly not yours. You instantly handed the apple to someone else. So the there's some tricky things that happen. It's like okay, that can take 10 minutes. It could take longer, but generally it'll take no more than 10 minutes, which is too long to be paying for coffee. You know, you swipe your credit card, your Bitcoin card. To authorize a transaction from your Bitcoin wallet, which is another word that I think is misleading, but okay, is switch it from there to the wallet of the Starbucks. You're not going to wait 10 minutes for the thing to complete validation.
Right, but it's fine for the order you place on Amazon.
Yep. And the other thing is the Starbucks can just make a risk assessment of like, okay, probably the guy has $5. Mm-hmm. So they can just take the chance, give you the coffee, You know, it's kind of like now when you go to a place, and some places, depending on how much the transaction is, they make you sign the credit card receipt or not. You know, sometimes if it's just like a $5 transaction, you can swipe your card and leave. If it's like a $110 transaction or a $500 transaction, then you swipe your card, they make you sign because it changes the risk profile. So like they'll take the risk for small transactions, but not for big ones. It changes their risk exposure. So companies, if Bitcoin was a thing, one of the things that the techno geeks complain about is that it's too slow to support the kind of in-person retail transactions that people are used to. And I think the kind of political people are like, are you crazy? We don't care about that. We're trying to save lives in, you know, Somalia. It's like, shut up. You know, they don't care about it being instantaneous. So anyway, and the slowdown piece is built in on purpose to create... That's how the validation works. Like it has to be there. It has to be slow because that provides the security. So it's kind of like something that can't be removed. And if you do try to remove it, then you have to figure out a different way to validate, which almost certainly means centralization.
Yeah, almost certainly. And I have heard the argument that if Bitcoin were to have the sort of load that the bank networks currently do, that it would be too slow for pretty much anything. I'm not sure how accurate that is, but
that sounds like the kind of surge problem that would happen with Uber. Mm-hmm. Like, because the thing we didn't really talk about is how do you get money into the system in the first place? You can't without using a central authority. There's no way to do it. So they cleverly created a way to do it, which was that if you raise your hand and say, okay, I'm going to set up the computer, I'm going to buy, set up, you know, the computer gear to validate transactions, AKA be a Bitcoin miner, the system gives you Bitcoin.
Yeah, every time you validate something.
Yes, that's how it gets into the system. And as those people pay other people for other things, then other people, it gets distributed around. So that's super clever when you think about it, because getting money into it's not a closed system. It's almost closed in the sense that it's wide open. There's no outside the system. Mm-hmm. It's weird. It's kind of hard to describe. But it's like, how do you get something? How do you create value inside the system that didn't come from some fiat money from the US government or whatever? And it's like, oh, you put workers in. You put workers inside the system. And that's what the validators are, the miners. So they do work for the system, for which they are paid by the system, which then they can distribute to other people on the network. It's genius.
Yeah.
So anyway, the whole concept was purpose-built for currency. So it's, I don't know, it's brilliantly self-contained. And I feel like it covers so many amazing bases. I don't know. It'd be interesting to see. There's definitely some competing public. There's a bunch of competing
public cryptocurrencies.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And so I think some are built on the same blockchain and others have their own concept. And so far what I'm seeing is that the validations are different. The way that they validate the transactions is different. Mm. And I will be interested to see. I don't know yet this might be an answered question that I just haven't stumbled across yet. If there's a way to do what happened with the internet, where so people, intranets or local area networks were around for a long time before they all got linked together as the giant global internet.
Yeah.
It will be fascinating to see, and this might be impossible, or it might be impossible to do without a central authority, but maybe not, is to link the blockchains, the different kinds.
Right. Some way for all those cryptocurrencies and different blockchains to come together into a big sort of network of things.
Right. So like what's...
There'd have to be some kind of shared protocol.
Yeah. There needs to be a gateway. And you would have to have a currency exchange type model, because mm-hmm. how do you determine how many Dogecoins you get for a block of Bitcoin?
Right, value is going to be different across different networks. You have to you have to have a currency exchange.
I guess that would kind of work itself out, because it's just two people. So if I say, "Hey, I want that apple that you have, Kelly," and you say, "Okay, what you got?"
Yeah.
And I say, "Oh, I got Bitcoin and I've got whatever Ripple." Okay, I'll take it's either two Ripples or I'll take one Bitcoin.
Yeah.
So you could imagine, it's almost like imagine going to a store and like all the prices are in, I don't know, pounds and USD. And you're like, oh, I've got pounds or I've got, but see, you can't do that in actual, some places like right over the border.
Right around the border you can, yeah.
But in a lot of, like in London, it was pretty rare for me to be able to use American dollars for anything.
Yeah, but I mean, you can certainly swipe your American credit card.
No, depends. Really? It depends. Yeah. Like I couldn't use, it has happened to me where I was like, oh, I'll pick up dinner. And they're like, no, you won't. Like, I can't use this. They're like, nope.
Like, oh, I've never found a place in Canada where I couldn't use my US bank card.
Yeah, same here. But like, if you go to a touristy place, you know, like I've been many times to the Cayman Islands, they'll just take US mm-hmm. dollars. Not everybody does, right. But some people do. Anyway, man, there's a ton of other topics. Like what happens so it can happen that two miners validate a block at the same time. It's not the same block necessarily, but it could contain the same chunk of transactions.
Mm-hmm.
And you end up with the double spend attack where I use two pictures of a $10 bill. So I pay you and Erica with the same picture of the $10 because it comes out of my account at the same time. But
that seems so incredibly rare.
It does happen apparently though. And it's accounted for by the fact that whichever chain, what it does is it forks the chain. So it creates two blocks that get attached to the previous segment of chain at the same time. And one of the chains will almost instantly be longer than the other one. So the shorter fork gets sent back. So the shorter fork gets chopped off and the transactions that were in it get sent back to the queue.
Okay. And revalidated again.
To be revalidated, which...
And then you can, within the revalidation, you look and say, oh yeah, this has already happened.
He doesn't have the money, right?
He doesn't have the money. This is not valid.
So,
interesting.
So there are two problems with that. It's super clever, but there are two problems with it. One is that it means that you can't even guarantee that any given transaction will take fewer than 10 minutes, which is how long it usually takes to validate a block.
Right. You have no idea when it's finished.
You have no idea.
Finished.
Technically, it could take forever. Technically, it could never get validated. Technically, but
yeah, that would take a Herculean feat of mathematical randomness. But yeah,
right. And the other problem is that it's not 100% clear. So I was really curious about timestamps. I'm like, how do they synchronize timestamps? Well, guess what? They don't. There's no notion of order. It's either on the chain or it's not. Once it's on the chain, there's an order.
Yeah,
but the transactions that are in the queue are not necessarily in order. So if I pay two people, if I basically write one, you know, I write two checks for $100, whichever one gets cash first is getting the money and the other person's out of luck.
Well, I mean, you know, that's the way it would be now if you wrote two checks for $100.
Mm-hmm. It is, but it's a concern. So if like, maybe I did it by accident. I can't think of a way that it's different than writing overdrawing your account, you know, whether it's mm-hmm. on purpose or not. I guess obviously it matters to the payee, but the lack of an issue is that it would be impossible to, or at least I have not come up with any kind of explanation of a way that you could do it on purpose, because it would require that it just so happens that transaction. So first of all, it would mean that I tried to do it on purpose.
Yeah.
And to my great fortune, it just so happened that those two transactions that I tried to make ended up both getting linked to the blockchain at the same time.
The exact same millisecond.
Yeah. And perhaps I'm confused about that, but it's just no way for you to, I mean, it'd be a way, there's no way right. for you to do it.
No, it's, there's not. You have zero control over it.
Yeah. There's no way for you to do it on purpose. It just could happen. And perhaps it offends someone's sensibility that the one that I transacted first might be the one that gets rejected and the one I transacted second gets accepted.
Yeah. I don't really see that as being an actual issue though.
Yeah. Certainly not a deal breaker.
No.
It would have got rejected anyway. Anyway, I can't think of a scenario, but perhaps a dear listener can think of a scenario where you could game that somehow. But compared to the regular banking system, it seems pretty ironclad.
Yeah, it does. But I don't know. We're at a minute six or an hour, 6 minutes. So we should probably.
Yeah, we should wrap. I'm sure we're going to talk about this more, which is probably good because we've been like between self-driving cars and AI, it's like enough already.
Yeah.
So I am super into this though.
Yeah. We'll be sure to talk about blockchain and 3D printing.
Yeah. Just mix it up a little bit. So I'm looking forward to getting some feedback from you, dear listener. Mm-hmm. I'm hopeful that someone in the audience is way smarter than this at this or about this than we are and can point us in the right direction because, man, it's easy to find a bunch of garbage related to this. Lots of hype and hand waving.
Yep.
But definitely potential game changing technology, and certainly will affect the way that we interact with the world. Currency is a big deal. And
yes.
Having a decentralized one would be... So looking forward to coming up with more specific examples, then wow, won't that be amazing? All right, cool. Well, that's our show for this week. I'm Jonathan Stark.
I'm Kelly Schaber.
And we hope you join us again for... my little window was on top of my other window.
You only say it every week.
I don't say it. I just read it. It's not the same thing. That's our show for this week. I'm Jonathan Stark.
And I'm Kelly Schaber.
And we hope you join us again next week for Terrifying Robot Dog. Bye.
Bye.
Would you like to see Kelly and I in your inbox once a week? Get new episodes delivered straight to you with show notes, links to additional content, and pictures of our $10 bills. Plus, you can reply to any message to suggest topics for future episodes. To get the inside track, go to terrifyingrobotdog.com and look for the Keep Me in the Loop button. That URL again is terrifyingrobotdog.com.